And you know, or is he just doing it for me? You know what I mean? And the fact is, of course he knew the prayer. He had been saying the prayer every day for 3 years. He, one more time, didn't want to be the sage AA. He didn't want the new guy to have to read it while he was there with his eyes closed being spiritual. He wanted to be inclusive of me. What a beautiful thing. What a little beautiful thing that I've never forgotten and that I've always, you know. And sometimes when I do it, I smile a little because I'm thinking, I know this guy thinks I'm a bozo who cannot retain this information. But it was a very, very lovely, very humble thing to do. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Aren't they nice to us? Which many of us had never attempted. Not once have I ever given the instructions in this and had the guy go, wow, you guys do that? I've been doing that for years. They're just so sweet to us, you know? My experience is that it's been what none of us have. I mean, me personally, unless the guy is somebody who's coming back to AA and has done the work, I've never personally met anybody who has done what we're going to ask you to do. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that, in ourselves that have been blocking us. As far as I know, there are only two places in the Big Book of AA where it tells you when to do an inventory or suggests it. Three places. In Bill's story, it says he was in the hospital a couple of weeks, and Abby came in and did step four with him and did step six and seven and all that stuff. So you could do it in your first 2 weeks and be like Bill. Here it says that the third step will have little permanent or lasting effect. In other words, turn on the weather. If you're not going to do this, turn on the weather channel, find out where there's a gale force wind blowing in the United States, go there and piss directly into it. It's going to be of no real value to you after a period of time to take the third step without actually finding out what you're turning over to God. And then the third place, which is my personal favorite, is in chapter 7. It talks about working with a newcomer, and it says the newcomer may want to start the work, but it might not be wise to start him out because if he slips later on, he might blame you for rushing him. Then you turn the page, and it says, but on your second visit, feel free to. So it basically says, don't start him out after you. Hi, fourth step. It says, try. Now, there are I had an interesting experience. I'll share with you. I had a disastrous experience with a guy who was my sponsor before my first sponsor. I was about 60, 70 days sober. I was had a writing contract over 20th Century Fox, and I was writing, and I met this guy in the program. He seemed like a good guy, and I asked him to sponsor me, and he gave me writing assignments on the first two steps, and on step three, gave me a writing assignment. He said, come over to my house, and we'll read it. I read it. We got on our knees. We said a prayer, and then we stood up, and he said to me, you know, I've done something for you, and I'd like you to do something for me now. You know, I've taken you through the step work, and I really need some help. I want to get involved in show business, and I want to meet some managers and some agents and stuff like that. And I was so sick at the time that I thought there was something wrong with me because it sounded so weird to me. I didn't know anything about AA. I had been here a couple of months. But I was so troubled that I thought, boy, why can't I do this? What's wrong with me? And I was smart enough to pull aside a guy in the program who had been around for a while and say, is this okay? And the guy said, flee. Throw your dress over your head and flee. And subsequently, this guy who did this is a really nice guy. He's still sober. He's a friend of mine. He made a mistake. I've made mistakes in sobriety. I've mishandled newcomers. I've made mistakes. He made a mistake. It was a mistake, you know. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is he had a lot of rules, which were fine and have worked for him, and he's sober, and he had rules that he passed on to guys he sponsored. Guys he sponsored were not supposed to start a four-step until they're 6 months sober. There's nothing wrong with that. That is, every group is autonomous. You need one or more to have a group. Everybody's got their own tradition. I see no problem with this at all. I'm just saying in the book, I only see three places where we're told to do it. That's meaningful to me in terms of AA. I've come here to talk about AA and my experience in AA. And I also believe that there are AA sponsor lines, AA groups, AA meetings that have their own tradition. And I think anybody who would indict that is not getting it. It's really not getting it. If I have to quit AA to join my home group, I don't want any part of it. I don't want any part of it. I love my home group. I love it. I really get what I need from my home group. I don't think my home group is a lick better than any other group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, if I got to quit AA to join my home group, I'm dead. I'm dead meat. So, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. Therefore, we started out on an inventory. And we've been asked to now take a look at three components in our lives. Resentments, fears, and sexual misconduct. Now, resentment is a strange and an interesting thing. You see, when I resent something, I just don't dislike it. I don't hate it. I re-experience this hatred and a dislike in a manner that I wake up and I water this hatred like a little flower. I care for it. I love this hatred, and I have to make sure that it's like the eternal flame. It has to continue to receive fuel in order to live. And I care for it. If I realize that I have forgotten to hate something for a period of time, I'm dismayed and disappointed. I feel like I have to redouble my hatred time to sort of make up for lost hatred time. I hate these things in a way that eats my brain and my heart and turns my life black and throws me out of my own life. There's not even any room for me in my own life. And my ability to re-experience this stuff and enlarge upon it. And one defect of character that I've recently discovered is the defect of lawyering. And what I mean by lawyering is in the court of Scott Redman, when someone is wrong, you can't be wrong enough. It's impossible to be wrong enough. Because believe me, due diligence never ends. We will continue this investigation. There's never, the verdict's in, but the trial is not over. We will go on until our brain blows up. If this process is not interrupted, I literally cannot have my own life. I can't. There's no room for me in my own life. So, there's no resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. Work a step a year. I'm asked to write three times in the inventory process. Twice on resentments, once on fears, once on sexual misconduct. I'm asked to write big controversy in AA, which I think is absolutely pointless and fruitless and ridiculous to even engage in, is how many columns are there? I don't care. I couldn't care less. I couldn't. Even if I took lessons, I couldn't care less. In the book, there's three specific columns. Who I'm resentful at, the cause, and what it affects. And then I have a corresponding defect of character list. That's what it says on the opposite page, on page 67, where I saw my faults, I listed them. Certain guys put that in the form of a column. Certain guys put it in the form of a list. The only time I think that you're in trouble is if you don't put it in any form at all. That's the only time I think you are in trouble. And this controversy is one of the most unbelievable wastes of time, although, again, I judge no man, that I've ever been confronted with. I write who I'm resentful at, the cause, what it affects, and a defective character list. Now, the defective character list for me, now, I will tell you if you're new, this used to be my favorite sentence in the big book of AA. It begins on the bottom of page 65 and goes to the top of page 66. And if you're new here, why, this could become your favorite sentence too. They're assuming that you've written a list of resentments. You've written a list of how you've been wronged. They're assuming you've written this list and you're looking at it. And it says, the first thing apparent was the world and its people were often quite wrong. That's enough for today. Close that book and go to sleep. It's poetic. It's beautiful. Don't read the next two pages. Because what the next two pages put forward is, again, they never argue with us. They're told to not argue us. They say, yes, you've been screwed, screwed, screwed. When you leave a place, they call the place you're going to and they say,
Howard's coming. Get him.
They're just, you've been wrong. You have been, and you're going to die. You're wrong and you're dead. You're wrong and you're dead because you experience this wrongdoing in a way that normal people don't experience it. You experience it like a spiritually sick person who has an allergy that leads them into a cycle of spree and remorse that they cannot get out of until they're traded out. You know, like when you get with those stockbrokers who just keep ding, ding, ding. You did great today. You have no more money, but you did great because we've traded you out. And it's the same deal. So it basically says you're right and you're dead because we're not telling you haven't been wrong. It's the first thing that's apparent. You've been screwed, brutally, mercilessly screwed. But here's the deal. You experience this screwing in a way that is so injurious that eclipses everything good, everything worthwhile in your life. Runs out between your fingers like a handful of water over and over again. So if you do not start to see this from a different point of view, you're going to die. That's what it says. Doesn't argue with you. And it says that these people that often, that wronged us were often spiritually sick. That it's people, places, and institutions. And that if I can put down the faults in me, I have to look at it from a completely different point of view. It's my inventory, not theirs. If you're taking people's inventory, please continue. It's good practice. If you ever do your own, you'll just zip through the mother. Okay? I found one loophole for a while. I said, I'm not judging him. This is an evaluation. And then a guy pointed out to me something that really shook me up. He said, you can't understand anything that you're judging. Ugh. That's terrible. It's really true. You see, if I stop judging you, that means that you won't be wrong. I got to keep you wrong at all costs. Once I declare you wrong, then I have to take a position of your wrongness. And then if other people think you right, then I have to re-educate them. or if they like you, I have to re-educate. No, you don't like him, really, because... And this guy pointed out to me that... I can't truly understand anything I judge. And if I can stop judging long enough to understand him, it doesn't mean I have to like him. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be wrong and he's going to be right. It just means that I'll understand him. The opposite of resentment is not always peace, love, joy, and happiness. The opposite of resentment sometimes can be the absence of murder. It can just be, I won't kill him. I will stay away from him. I don't like him. I cannot be helpful to all people, but I must at least take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. What a relief. What a relief, because I can't like everybody, because I don't. You know? I have to take a different view of this re-experiencing of this dislike view. When I saw my faults, I listed them. I'm resentful at Scott for being loaded the night that his father died. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambitions, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What is it in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. He comes and touches me on the head. What is it in me that if it was gone, I wouldn't be resentful at myself anymore? I'm a grudge holder. I'm not living in today. I'm re-experiencing that night that I showed up that he was loaded. I have shame. I'm shamed. I'm playing God. I'm not trusting in God. If I trusted in God, I'd know that I was moving on to a better thing, and I wasn't the guy who couldn't show up for my old man the night he died. I'm an opportunist, and I'm filled with self-pity. If you could bottle self-pity, it would not crack off the market tomorrow. Better drug. More available. When I'm filled with self-pity, I get a little lump in my throat. My eyes get watery. I slump forward. It's good dope. And I'm resentful at my aunt. Well, let's go to the Nazis first. I like the Nazis. I'm resentful at the Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. It says that we invariably placed ourselves in a position to be hurt. It says in that second paragraph of page 62 that I made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. I'm resentful at the Nazis for slaughtering Jews. How have I possibly put myself in a position to be hurt? How have I possibly played any part in this at all? I haven't. What does it affect? My self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Well, on my original inventory, I had coward because I was too scared to go kill the Nazis. And then my sponsor said, hold it a second. It doesn't say, He said, is the resentment your fault? I said, absolutely not. He said, I didn't ask you if the event was your fault. I'm asking you if the resentment is your fault. I said, what? He said, I agree with you. The event's not your fault. Is the resentment your fault? Every time, with no exception, invariably with no loophole. Was it my fault that the... No, absolutely not. I was resentful of my aunt Jean, because when I was a little boy, I was about 3 years old, she pinned my arms to my side so my cousin could hit me. Was that my fault? Absolutely not. That's unacceptable behavior. It's unacceptable to do that to a little kid. I don't care if the kid's a brat. To leave a kid, and I don't even know that I was a brat at the time. All I know is that I was rendered physically helpless so I could be struck. I'm sorry. For me, and other guys might not feel that way, it's unacceptable. It's not, I'm a parent. It ain't okay. Was the event my fault? No. Was the resentment my fault? Absolutely. Every time, without variation, with no loopholes. I'm resentful at my aunt for holding me so I could be struck. What does it affect? Everything. What are my defects of character? I'm a grudge holder. I'm a hypocrite. I've hurt my kids. I'm a character assassin. I've talked bad about her everywhere I possibly could. I'm not living in today. I keep going back to that. I'm filled with self-pity, and I'm an opportunist because I've used this opportunity to leverage pity and poison her to other people. And I'm playing God. Things aren't going according to the Scott Redmond program, a fabulous program. What could I possibly, when it came time to write my defects against the Nazis, it was like science fiction time. But what are the defects? I'm a hypocrite. I hear, because I'm a racist. I'm resentful of them being racist. I know I've got more than a couple of racist bones in my body, knee-jerk reactions to situations. Plus, I hear people have a German accent. I don't even want to know them. I have a racist, knee-jerk reaction to hearing that voice. I have no idea who these people are. I'm also, again, an opportunist because I've used it to leverage self-pity and used it to sort of be an authority on what I don't know. Unforgiving, grudge holder, not living in today. I want to tell you, when I started realizing the difference between the event and the resentment, my life opened up in a way that I had never even dreamed possible. Absolutely. And my ability to help other people opened up in a way, because I've sponsored guys who've been through horrible stuff. Child abuse, sexual molestation, growing up in alcoholic homes. Horrible, miserable situations. How do you get the crowbar in there? How do you open up? And one thing I'm going to talk about when I talk about Step 12 is that very interesting and very difficult component of 12-step work that presents itself to guys I sponsor who have grown up in alcoholic homes. Because when you grow up in an alcoholic home, when you are an untreated Al-Anon, when you're in that situation, one of the things that is typical of that thinking is that somehow, some way, the alcoholics, just they're going to get over on you. Believe, no matter what you do, no matter what they say, nothing's safe. Whatever's in the refrigerator or under the bed or in the bank account, it doesn't matter what they say. And I have found with men that I work with, some of them, not all of them, who have grown up in alcoholic homes, that there's a little something extra there. There's a little something extra to deal with, and it's been very helpful to talk about it in an open and honest way and to deal with that little something. It's been very helpful in them, their ability to extend themselves in 12-step work. So that's the writing on step 4 that I got to do. And then there's the fear inventory. And I talked a bit about it last night, but it says... In here, it says that fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. The fabric of our lives is shot through with it. And how incredibly true. And the other phrase in there on the top of 68, which I love, it says, when I was cocky, it was worse. And man, that's when I was at my worst. I'm not scared. Watch this. Absolutely bad times. Nothing ever good came out of that, ever. I'm not scared. Watch this. And it says there, right at the top of 68, there's a key phrase. It says, we listed the fears that did not have connection to personal resentment. Now, that's a tricky thing, okay? Fear of confrontation is a big fear of mine. Fear of financial insecurity is a big one of mine. You know, I just love this, that in the middle of step 9, if AA had a PR guy, when they're writing this book, this is 1937 to 1939, global financial collapse. People are doing half gainers off buildings. businessmen, ex-millionaires are selling apples in the street. And these yo-yos put in the middle of step nine that you will have freedom from fear of financial insecurity. I guarantee you, if there had been a PR guy, he would have gone, no. Promise him anything. Promise him, you know, a bowl of fruit. I mean, give him anything, but don't promise him this. It was about as outside a promise as you could have possibly made. And the fact is they paid off. They delivered. You know, so whenever I start getting, I had a guy once call me who I sponsor. He said, "I'm in real estate hell." I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, we just fell out of escrow." I said, "You know what? You're a little shy of real estate hell, actually. Real estate hell is having a fight with a guy and beating him up so that you can sleep in the refrigerator box. And then once you get in there, you hear rain falling on the box. That is actually real estate hell. You're in real estate discomfort. Falling out of escrow is a little different. That's like one guy sponsor once called me and said, I've had a hellish day. And I said, actually, for you, a hellish day is working all day to get a shot and then knocking the spoon over. That's actually for you. That's particularly meaningful to a couple of guys here who were thought it was funny and sad at the same time. So I could be frightened of the police, but the fact is I'm also resentful at myself for knocking over 7-Elevens. So that's not a pure fear, okay? I've got a personal resentment in connection with that. So when I write this stuff, I find that these lists kind of feed each other. Sometimes a pure fear will come up, and I'll go and I'll write it on my fear list. And sometimes the fears, if I take a look at them and I really ask myself, is this not in connection with personal resentment? I'll have to say, you know what? There is a bunch of baggage there that I need to take a look at. So pure fears. I'm frightened of dying, I'm frightened of living, I'm frightened of being alone, I'm frightened of being with people, I'm frightened of success, I'm frightened of failure, I'm frightened of having sex, I'm frightened of not having sex. If you take a look at the average fear list, it's an architecture for a life that can't be lived. It truly is. I mean, a fear list with any... that's written with any degree of honesty is usually if you stayed away from all the stuff that you're frightened of. It's sort of like the 12 traditions. You know, they had a list of all the rules that all the AA groups had written up for themselves before the 12 traditions were codified. And when they threw them all together, if you followed all the rules that had been written for all the AA meetings, no one would have been able to join AA. It was so exclusive instead of inclusive. And I find the same thing to be true with fears. I had the fear of animals, which I talked about last night. I had a fear of dying on mine. I had a fear of living on mine. I also, I'll just tell you, I had a terrible fear of being cut by newspaper. I had a fear that when I opened the newspaper, that the newspaper was going to cut me. Now, I was never going to admit this to another human being, you know. And I said, Father, and I'll talk about more of this in 6 and 7. Father, please remove this terrible fear of being cut by newspaper. And the voice didn't say, stop reading the paper. The voice said something like, oh, stop. or you lay it down on the table or something. At any rate, we'll talk about 6 and 7 more when we get into 6 and 7, but we're asked to write a list of fears. And then the third section of the inventory, the fourth time what we're asked to write, is about sex. On the second paragraph of page 69, everybody knows the page 96 joke, right? Does everybody know that? Good. On page 69, we are asked to write about basically 7 points. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? What should we have done instead? Not what could I have done instead, what should I have done instead? What could I have done instead? I could have dismounted when I realized she was dead. That's what I could have done instead. That's what I was capable of doing. Thanks for recording that, Terry. I really appreciate that. That's what I could have done instead. What I should have done instead was something quite different, believe you me. So it talks about in the second two paragraphs, oh man, just came out, didn't it? Something I picked up in my reading. oh man. In the second two paragraphs are two of the most powerful paragraphs in the big book of AA. It talks about deciding what kind of man I want to be. And I don't use this just for sex. I say, what kind of man do I want to be in there? What's my sane, sound ideal? It says for a future sex life, but I say sane, sound ideal for my future life. And it says that I'm going to ask God to help mold me to those, that I'm going to ask to walk in partnership with him towards those goals. That's incredible. I never got that in therapy. I love therapy fine, but I never got that. That is truly moral psychology, you know? And where was I? Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. What should I have done instead? Now, on my original four-step, I had a lot of stuff down there. I had masturbation down there. Now, nobody, you know, it was dark in the room, it was scary, and I was alone. Some guys, masturbation bothers them, some it doesn't. Some guys, if you're masturbating to the point of dehydration, might be a problem if you find yourself on an IV drip by the end of a weekend with a hell of a video rental bill. At any rate, we've got this whole new world of cyber sex. I actually, a couple of years ago, got to give a direction I've given many times since, but it was the first time that I got to say to a guy, go home, pray, and don't touch your mouse. You know, if God really had a sense of humor, you'd need two hands to work a mouse, wouldn't you? Yeah, the digital world has really opened up a whole thing for us alcoholics, hasn't it? At any rate, I know that guys who had to put that on their inventory and guys who now have not, you know, the opposite of this stuff is not, I shall not touch myself, and I will have missionary-style sex if I'm lucky enough to have sex with any human being. And I to find a way to be in the world that's comfortable and pleasing and a good place for me. I know that guys have made decisions that to live happy, joyous, and free in marriages that where there is no sex. I know guys who have found a place to be that. I know guys who have used the steps to get to that place. I know guys who have found a way to have a wonderful, robust, romantic, sexy, adventurous time in their marriage or in their relationship or in their life. I do know this, that if I'm continuing to be selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, it says on page 70, I'm quite sure to drink. What does that mean? It's just incredibly clear. I'm quite sure to drink. This is not a theory. This is from our experience, you know? And, I walked out on my wife and kids, a couple of months before I got sober. I was working down in Texas and I walked out on Nancy and the boys. Where had I been selfish? I wanted, and it's an interesting thing. It says we put this all down on paper. It doesn't, it's the first time we're not asked to write a list. It says we got this all down on paper, these 7 points. And I don't think they wanted you to write everything. Like, I don't think they cared if there was like a full moon and the Chablis had a blush. I don't think they care about that crap. I think they want to really know, where were you selfish, dishonest, and considerate? I want to digress for 1 minute. One of the reasons that I believe that there are no written instructions on how to do the first two steps in the big book of AA, and it bears mentioning now, and again, not that all the other stuff we do is not good. I really believe it is. But I believe that the reason why would these guys give written instructions on every other step and not on these two? I believe it's because they knew that when at the end of the day, if you did have not some notion that something was wrong, that we'd be pissing into a gale force wind. That there was no way we were going to turn that corner, that they were intuitive on some level, that I had to know something was wrong, that this alcohol thing wasn't working out for me, and that I needed some kind of help. I mean, in their broadest design, that's what they are. You know, and now by step four, I am getting into the specific architecture of this problem. Although ultimately, the problem itself will be an enigma wrapped in a question, wrapped in a why do some people get it and some people don't. Who the hell knows, you know? I just know what I'm doing until 12 o'clock tonight. And where was I selfish? Well, I wanted the other woman. I also wanted to keep my family going. My marriage had been screwing up my dating for 8 years by that time. and I write a little bit about how it happened. These are not yes and no answers. Selfish, dishonest. I lied to Nancy and I lied to her about what I was going to be doing Christmas, where I was at work. I lied to the other woman that I was really not going to leave Nancy, and I talk about the lies. Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. I was not considerate of what was happening to my children because of the disparagement of in lies and truth and all the troubles with Nancy. The boys were being pounded into the dirt. I was also not considerate. I was working with this woman. I was inconsiderate of the feelings of my coworkers because they knew something was going on, and inconsiderate of this woman's family. And I tell a little story about it. Unjustifiably aroused jealousy. Well, I was telling one I was one place, one I was the other place. And ultimately, and this was a big turn for me, I realized I was getting jealous of people who I thought were living a normal life. Boy, that self-pity is just, that puts you way out on the plank alone. Jealousy, suspicion. I became suspicious of my own sanity. I became suspicious that one knew something the other wasn't supposed to know. And then I talk about suspicions that I created at work and in both homes. Suspicion and bitterness, the whole thing created bitterness. Bitterness in myself, in the other woman's family, in my boss, in my coworkers, in my family, in my kids, everybody, and I tell a little story about it. What should I have done instead? It's a very interesting idea. Now, for me, and this is just who I am, these are my morals. What I should have done instead was not, I never should have talked to the woman or had an adulterous thought or experience in any way, shape, or form. I should have been having missionary-style sex with my wife and sponsoring men I hate. That's what I want my life to be. It wasn't that. What it was what I should have done instead was I should have either committed to the other woman and left my marriage, or I should have committed to my marriage and been there. I never should have done both at the same time. That's the kind of man that I wanted to be. That's the way that I felt. That was right for me. That what I had done that to me was so wrong was not fall in love with another woman. You know what? That happens in the world. That could have happened to me. What was wrong was the price I made everybody pay for my feelings. That was wrong. And that's the fourth step that I did. And I think that we're a little shy here, but there are enough eyes rolling back in the sockets. You stayed awake. I love you, man. Okay. Let's break and we'll come back in, 25-2 or 22 or something like that? Bob will call us back? 25-2. See you at 25-2. Thanks, God, and I'm an alcoholic. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God. Try to get through step 10 today. Step 11, we'll touch on step 12 a little bit. We'll expand on it tomorrow, and we'll have our discussion on forgiveness. There's some more copies of the forgiveness papers over there from Sermon on the Mount. If you've read one and want to pass it around, anybody who wants to take a look at it, it's not completely necessary for tomorrow, but you might want to take a look at it. It's a very interesting thing in Fox's book. He takes the Sermon on the Mount passage by passage and discusses it in his book. And then in the back of the book, he takes the Lord's Prayer. Now, I'm a New York Jew. I was brought up in the Bronx. And I probably spend more time talking about Gospels and talking about different stuff as a result of my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous and becoming teachable and becoming open to all lessons. I was asked by a man I sponsor to become the godfather to his children, and we went to a Catholic church, and I held the baby, and a lot of people from AA there, and the priest said to me, if these parents die, will you raise this child Catholic? And I said, yes, and then he looked at me, and he said, and the funny thing is the guy I sponsored before the baptism said to the priest, you know, the godfather's Jewish. So, and the priest kept saying, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. And the guy who I sponsored figured that the priest was going to do something, you know, special or something. And the priest looked at me and said, do you believe Jesus Christ was the child, was the Son of God, died on the cross, and was resurrected the next day? And all the guys, like who I know from AA, kind of went, looked like a Merrill Lynch commercial, you know? And I looked at the priest and I went, yes, I do. What, are we going to argue about this now? You know, it's like, I was completely open and willing. And, you know, what does it say in our book? How did that guy in chapter 4, how did he get sober? When he tumbled from the bed and said, who am I? He heard that voice and said, who are you to not believe in God? Who are you? Who are you to say no now? Who are you to not say yes, to be inclusive and move forward and participate in this thing? It was great. It was really one of the great things that's ever happened to me. When I wrote my fourth step between 6 months and 9 months, I went to my sponsor. I made an appointment with him. We got on our knees again, and we took step three again together. And he explained to me the reason why we were doing that together is because now we were actually learning what step three meant. By doing this fifth step together, we were actually going to learn what the content was. And then he read to me the three and a half page section on step five from the Big Book of AA. And it's a very interesting thing. In the text of this section on step five, it's a couple of interesting points here. It says on the first page of step five, the reading of step five is admitted to God, to ourself, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And in the book on page 72, it really isn't couched that way. It says, this requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our defects. It doesn't say wrongs, doesn't say faults, doesn't say anything but defects. How am I going to tell somebody the exact nature of my defects unless I list them? But I have listed them here. This brings us to the fifth step of the program of recovery mentioned in our preceding chapter. It says that if I am holding on to certain facts about myself, that we have seen people later stumble terribly because they've kept a little something to themselves. Just a little something to themselves, you know. And on page 73, there is a devastating description of the double life that the alcoholic leads. And there's a key phrase here. It talks about waking up, having remorse, crushing it back down with more drinking. These, as fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. And here's the phrase. That makes for more drinking. It doesn't make for drinking. And I'll tell you why, for me, that's such an important phrase. If therapy had worked, if my family had made me an alcoholic, my nutty family, therapy would have worked. It would have worked. I would have worked out my family issues. Sometimes I can go to an AA meeting and not even hear a passing reference to the Big Book, God, or the steps. I just hear about issues and boundaries. I want to tell you something. The not drinking part is a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. It's that damn not drinking thing. If you don't drink, you'll have an issue and a boundary. I guarantee you. You'll wind up with both. But if you have issues and boundaries before you stop drinking, for me, I would have been doomed. And it makes for more drinking. This crushing down, this neurosis, this remorse, it makes for more drinking. It doesn't make for drinking. What makes for drinking is physical, mental, and spiritual. This bizarre alchemy, this weird mix that nothing else seems, certainly nothing else treats with even a fraction of the effectiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's been very, very important for me. And it talks about this double life, the face that I show the world, the face that I really seem to know about myself, and how horribly true about me. And then it says a couple of really funny things. Like it says in step three also, I really get a kick out of this, and they sort of echo it in step five because, of course, this book was written before there was a fellowship. So it talks about step three, and it says, we found it desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife. Best friend or spiritual advisor. Fat chance of me taking the third step with my wife when I came into AA. And it says also in the description of step five, because they didn't know that if we'd be properly situated to have somebody hear our inventory, that we might take it with our wife. Oh my God. Or another family member. Look, there's somebody here who might have done that. I'm not indicting that. I'm just saying the idea for me was pure science fiction that I would sit down and do that. And then it talks about how if you're doing that you cannot reveal something to somebody that's going to injure them. I have had some of the single most repulsive, grotesque experiences of my life of having people in AA make amends to me. They have been some of the most singularly inappropriate, ridiculous experiences I've ever had. When I was at Summerfest here a couple of years ago, a guy walked up to me after my talk and said, you know, I've heard you before, and you really kind of made me sick, and I really saw that you were speaking, and I thought, who the hell needs this crap? But I went to see you, and I really liked the talk. My God, have you had sex with my wife, too? What else is going on? Did she strangle my dog? Come on, let's get it off our chest now. I have a friend in AA, when anytime someone comes up to him and make amends to him in AA, he always says, is this something I should know about? I've really... under the guise of spiritual tool, I've had spiritual tools used as weapons. I've seen it happen, and you know what? I'm sure I've done it too. I am sure that I have injured people in the course of my spirituality. I can't imagine that I haven't done it too. I sat down, and when I went to do my fifth step with my sponsor, I swear to you, I don't know how I had this in my head. I thought I was going to drop off my inventory. He was going to read it and then put together some comments for me and comment afterwards. If I realized consciously that I was going to have to read this stuff, there's no way that I ever would have written this much. There's no way. I had written hundreds of resentments, a long fear inventory, lots and lots of sexual inventories. And when I realized the fact that I was going to have to sit and read this stuff, I was horrified. It took me a long time to read my inventory. It was about 11 and a half hour process. I have heard inventories read to me that have taken 15 minutes. The shortest one was 15 minutes. The longest one was 22 and a half hours. And both of the guys are dead. Because it has been my experience that it doesn't matter how long your inventory does, if you don't continue to do the work, you're going to get sick and bad stuff is going to happen. I don't know. I have no idea how long a guy's initial inventory should be, but my experience has been if it's not followed, it says that step three will have little permanent or lasting effect unless followed by the strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. It's been my experience that if a fourth step is not followed by a tenth step, that the fourth step becomes some sort of dusty trophy in a case. It's not maintained, and I get sick, I get sicker, I share my sickness with you, and I share my ass right out of the door. So I did my inventory with my sponsor, and then he instructed me to take step 6 and 7. And he explained to me that on the bottom of page 69, the last two paragraphs on 69, I would see the instructions on how to do a 6 and 7 step with my sexual life. That I take all the situations where I've written what I should be doing instead, and I ask God to help walk me towards that. To help mold me, to have a sane and sound ideal sex life, to walk towards that ideal with me. And it says, I go through each particular situation and see what I should do about each specific one. That'll lead me into 8 and 9 on each one. 6 and 7 on fears, the prayer that's kind of in there on page 68, is it says on the bottom of the third paragraph, I ask God to remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be. It's much the same. It's exactly what I shared last night. Father, please remove this terrible fear of animals. Turn my attention to what you would have me be. I wait for an answer. My inner voice said, stay away from animals, and then humbly rely upon you. It says on the bottom of the second paragraph, just to the extent as we think he would have us, we do as we think would have us, and we humbly rely upon him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? So it says, I ask, I receive, and then I actually take the action. And if I take the action, I'm going to immediately commence to outgrowing fear. To the best of my knowledge, there's only two places in the big book of AA where it talks about things happening right away. And you know what? I'm a right away kind of guy. I like right away. Any other intravenous drug users here? You're right away guys too. I know that. And it says that I will immediately commence to outgrow fear, and then earlier in the book it says that I immediately have a sense of ease upon taking a few drinks. So that seems to be on both sides of the fence there. I'll go with the removal of fear. And then on resentments, if I take a look on the section of page 6 and 7, which is really interesting because it is one page long, from the middle of page 75 to the middle of page 76, it's barely a page long and probably covers more spirit or as much spiritual territory as is covered in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I was told to go through my defects, have a discussion with God about them, and ask for their removal. And I have taken that process and moved it into the 10th step. I have taken that process of writing that fourth step. I do my 10 steps exactly the way I did my fourth step. I do 6 and 7 as a result of that. And the expansion in my life that has been created by that structure has been absolutely remarkable. So I did that. I wrote up my 8-step list, which had my wife, my kids, my father on there. I didn't know what I was going to do about any of them, particularly my dad. I had just about every employer I had ever worked for. I was a terrible thief. And I mean a terrible thief. I was caught most of the time. I try to share this anytime I talk because it's just the best reading of Step 8 I've ever heard. It was done by this guy. I was a couple of months sober. I was out at my old home group, and there was a guy there from New York. His name was Nino, and he had never been at this meeting before. And I've never seen him since. He was there with a hospital group. He had a hospital wristband, and he had never read chapter 5 before. And he was reading it for the first time in front of this men's group. And he got up to step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! He looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what's in here?" And it was perfect. It was the only thing that I saw on the steps. I didn't see anything else when I first saw him. Not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew how to give it back. No way. Not the car. When I called that guy back to pay him back for the car, his voice was exactly the same. He said, "You're paying me back?" It's like he was frozen on the phone all that time. And if you're new, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, you know. And 8's really not the annoying one. 9. It's really, really annoying. So I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't know what I was going to do about all this stuff. I didn't know what I was going to do about all of this stuff. And my sponsor just said, do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and let's see what happens. I started sponsoring men very early in sobriety. I started sponsoring men at about 11 months of sobriety. I had already worked through my steps once. I had done my 8-step list and started my 9-step. And I asked my sponsor if it was okay, because the guy asked me, and he said, just don't give away anything you don't have. Don't give away anything that you don't have, and give away what you've got. If all you've got is a car and a quarter, give somebody a ride and lend them a nickel. Of what you have, give it all away. First guy I ever started to sponsor was a guy who I still sponsor today. His name's Roland. I've been sponsoring him for 15 years. He's 15 years sober, and he used to call my house every night, and he'd leave a message on my machine every night. He'd say, "Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Goodbye." And he'd hang the phone up. 5 years after this, when I was 6 years sober, my son Micah came to me, and he said, "You know, Dad, when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the tape. And once I heard Roland's voice on the tape, I knew everything was okay and I could go to bed." And this is the kid I told there was no God. I had told Micah there was no God. I told Micah basically, you know, when it's scary and it's dark and you can't go to sleep, tough, because that's all there is. That's what I told him. And Roland came in and tucked him in every night. I didn't even know it. Absolutely didn't know it. Stuff happens in Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't even know. You don't even know what you're doing, you know. I had an old friend named Howard Cooper who was a Skid Row bum. He was thrown out of the Harbor Lights Salvation Army on 5th Street in L.A., and it takes a lot to get thrown out of there. That's a Promethean effort. And I loved Howard. He died 22 years sober. And Howard was... he was a year sober or so, and he was asked to go 12-step this guy named Sullivan down on Skid Row Hotel, and he went down there with this other guy, and they 12-step Sullivan subsequently drank and died. And 9 years later, Howard was about 10 years sober, and this guy walks up to him in a meeting and says, "You know, you saved my life." And Howard said, "I don't know who you are." And the guy said, "Do you remember this guy Sullivan?" And Howard said, "Yeah, I remember him." And this guy said, "The night that you were 12-stepping him down in that hotel, I was hiding under the bed, and I heard everything that you said, and I have never had another drink." You just don't know. You just don't know what you're doing when you're doing it. You know? I loved Howard Cooper. His kids had been taken away from him, and he got a public defender to try to get to see his kids again. And the public defender said to him, "Can you show up for this hearing next week sober?" And Howard said to her, "All I can tell you is if I do that day what I did today, I'll be sober that day." He was just an incredible guy. And right before he passed away, he was driving out to Vegas for a weekend, and he hopped on the freeway at night. He hopped on the freeway. He gets out on the freeway in the desert. The cop pulls him over. He goes, "Oh, shit." This cop walks up to the window and says, "Are you a friend of Bill's?" And Howard goes, "Yeah, what? The cop said, "Well, I saw your bumper sticker." He said, "I'm in the fellowship, and I like to start my shift off with a little fellowship before I start." You know, Howard's ready just to say, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it." He was a great guy, really an incredible guy. I had the incredible experience of being around some remarkable people when I was new in sobriety. My favorite newcomer story was told by this guy, my old home group, by a guy named Bill. His name was Bill W. And he was from England. He used to say he was the town drunk of London. And his favorite story about newcomers, which I want to tell posthumously for Bill, is that this old-timer grabbed this newcomer in a meeting. Had a couple of months, they had a 12-step call, and he grabs this newcomer, and they go on this 12-step call, and they drive to the end of the highway. They hit a dirt road. They go out on the dirt road, and they reach this, like, lean-to that doesn't even have a door. It's just a burlap flap, you know? And they go in there, and there's this drunk sitting in stained underwear in this lean-to that he's sitting on this stained mattress. The only other thing in the place is a can with a candle in it, and the guy's sucking on a bottle of wine, and the new guy looks at this guy and says, look, I'm new, I've only been here a couple of months, but I will tell you, I know one thing for sure, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to lose all this. And I love that story. I love that story so much because it's the truth. He's going to lose all that, number one. And that's the message that the new guy can carry that the old timer can't carry. Not like that. Not that beautifully. Not that true. For the newcomer, it was absolutely true. You know. And for the old timer, it was a wonderful thing to watch. I love that story a lot. Early on in sobriety, I had to learn what was going to happen to me as a result of the 10-step. I had my 8-step list written up, and I was starting my journey to make my amends. Without step 10, I personally don't think that I would have completed them. Also, for me, without step 10, there is no step 12. I will get pissed off at the men I sponsor. I will get pissed off. I will say really stupid stuff. I will get manipulative. I will get wacky. Newcomers act just like newcomers. You know, guys will call me and say, how are you? And I'll say, well, my wife's on fire and my crotch just blew up. And they'll go, oh, really? Anyway, I'm having transmission problem. I once told a guy once, if you ever mention your car to me again, I'm going to kill you. Don't even say the word car. And I had to write a 10-step about the guy. I was not... Maybe I could have said that in a different way. At any rate, I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in my first year of sobriety, I had a lot of writing jobs. And I was doing real well and getting sober and kind of becoming a spiritual Goliath. And I had an overture made to me at the end of that year by a studio to... direct a situation comedy. And I thought that if I got that job directing the sitcom, that it would really be helpful to the guys I sponsor because they would see me prospering thusly. And my brain blew up. And I didn't get the job. And I went mad. And I almost drank. And I went to my sponsor at that time and I told him what I'd done. I was humiliated. And he said to me, I guess you've got the show business God. I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God. He said, so, okay, God keeps you sober, and you almost drank because you didn't get a show business job, so I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly. Now, when I came in AA, I had heard people about God getting people jobs, God getting people relationships, God getting people parking spaces. Oh, no, no, not the parking space God, not the parking space God. What if you don't get a space? You know, if you've got a parking space, God, and he gives you a space, well, by God, why don't you pass it on? No. Exactly. So I understood his annoying question, his annoying statement, and he said, you know, I had to sit down and write about it. Armour's Enfield Scott for almost drinking. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. Absolutely. What are the defects of character? Well, I'm embarrassed. I mean, I'm ashamed. I have spiritual pride. I thought that I deserved to get this job, and if I didn't, then I got to drink. I was resentful at the company for not giving me the job. You know, it affects, again, it's a five bagger. And what are the defects? I'm not trusting in God. I'm playing in God. I have spiritual pride. I'm ashamed. I have a false sense of entitlement. I'm greedy. Now, you know, sometimes I've been confronted with people saying, geez, aren't you being rough on yourself? No, I'm telling the truth. For me, those things were operating in me that led me to a resentment that almost got me drunk. This is hard on myself. You're an idiot. You're a moron. You're a waste of oxygen. That's hard on myself. I acted in a greedy, self-centered, selfish, shameful way. That's how I acted. And now I'm going to go to the power that runs the universe and say, can you help me? He's never said, I'm stumped. He's never said, geez, I just don't know what to do about this. Ever, ever, ever. I've never gotten that reaction. Now, you know, sometimes, and it says in the 12 and 12, we should not only write character defects, we should write character assets. I know that works for people. It doesn't work for me. I've been working on a character asset list for 49 years. I'd happily show it to you. I spend a lot of my life kind of, it just doesn't work for me. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work for me that works for other guys. Sometimes my sponsors say, try praying for the guy. So I pray for him. Father, help this man. Kill him. He needs killing. It'll be good for him and good for everyone. So Don would say, can't you just stop the prayer in the middle? It just didn't work for me. It didn't work for me, but it works for other people. I had to sit down and go, I'm resentful at the cause. These are the defects, and then move on and do 6 and 7. So it was clear to me when I did 6 and 7 on this particular resentment that I had to give God show business, that I hadn't given him show business. I had to get rid of the show business God. So I said, Pop, I did 6 and 7. I read it to my sponsor. I went through the defects. I said, you got it. Take it. I'll do anything you want for a living. I will do anything you want. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't on the list. I had forgotten to give him the list, of course, but this was not on the list. Now, in L.A., when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, and you make a lot of dough. You're working, it's Teamster dough. You're working on a movie set, on a vehicle. It's a great job. I mean, it can be a six-figure job. It can be. It wasn't for me, but it's a great job. But I'm Scott Redman. So the first morning that I'm catering this movie, the star and executive producer of the film is a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he sticks his head on the truck that morning and he says, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? How you doing? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. And I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, yeah, I'm getting the gift now. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful gift, this gift of sobriety. Man, my sponsor said, sounds like you've got a resentment. And I had to work step 10. I had to put the resentment down against myself working on the kitchen truck. I had to put the resentment down against the guy for seeing me. I don't know why. He was a nice guy. He didn't go, he didn't rub it in. He was a sweet guy. But I resented him for seeing me. And this started me out on a journey, on a lesson that has put me in the middle of my life over and over and over again. Because I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors, actors and actresses who I had directed in soap operas. I wound up serving people who had been my stage managers. And I would come back to the home group with a new tale of humiliation every week. And they go, ha, 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 tears streaming down their face. And I got to help some guys who felt that they fell from a height when they came to AA. They hadn't reached the top rank in AA, which is Child of God, from which there is no place to fall. I had a friend named Paul who felt that he had fallen from a height in AA, and he used to say this prayer, and he'd say, Father, I'm willing to do anything for a living, but please don't be make it as bad as what you did to Scott. And I mean, it was unbelievable. The situation comedy that I didn't get before I became a cook, I'm in an AA meeting. One of the stars of that situation comedy walks into the AA meeting I'm in. And I go, oh, no. On my inventory, from the time I was 5 years old till the time I was about 10, there was a kid in my neighborhood named Mark. Mark used to kick my ass every day. He'd kick my ass, humiliate me at my first kissing parties with other girls. This guy was an anathema in my life. He was all over my inventory. I had harbored this my whole life. He'd wake up and say, "Where's Scott Redmond? I want to kick his ass," as far as I was concerned. Nightmare. He was that nightmare bully in my life. So this guy from the Situation Comedy comes in, he hears me share, and he says, "Will you show me the work in the Big Book of AA?" I said, "Sure." So I invite him over to my house. I ask him to do some reading. He comes over to my house. He says, "Jesus, I'm sorry I'm a few minutes late. Our new director, my job, Mark." Now, this is a world. This is from, we're talking Bronx, L.A. This is, we're talking a lot of time. We're talking about 25 years, 3,000 miles. It's the same Mark. He's now got my job. And I wanted to go, "Do you have anything else to do, God? What, Job's dead? What the, you know? What is it with you? What the hell is going on here?" It was unbelievable. And I'm calling my sponsor, and he's gagging. I mean, he's like falling off his chair because it's another value for me of going to a guy who knows my whole story. He knows how funny this is. He knows because he's heard the 10 resentments against this guy for kicking my ass. Oh my God in heaven. And this is what happened, is that the resentment kept coming back. It kept coming back and coming back. Okay, so what do? I'm resentful about the same thing over and over again. What do? It says in the description of step 6 and 7 that I go over the first 5 propositions in the book. I go over them and I ask myself, have I done them thoroughly yet? Am I trying to make mortar without sand? I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. Okay, let's go to another one. This will really annoy some people. I'm still very overweight in my estimation. I was a lot more overweight. I weighed over 300 pounds. I was resentful at Scott for being fat. I went to OA, where I told them I was a circuit speaker, and they were so very impressed. I would have asked for help, but my mouth was full. If you bend over after a shower and more than a cup of water comes out of your navel, you might want to do something about that. Okay, I'm resentful at Scott for being overweight. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character? I'm a glutton. No, don't fight me on this. I'm self-serving. I'm self-serving. I'm not letting anybody else feed me. I'm doing it all myself. I'm not trusting God. I'm also ashamed. I'm a people pleaser, and I have lust because I'd like to have sex, but I'm injuring people at this point. And I... Okay, so I do it. I read it. I pray about it, and I go out and have a bowl of spaghetti and a pie. So something's wrong here. There's something wrong. What am I doing in this area? I'm resentful of myself for working on a kitchen truck, and the shame keeps coming back in a torrent. What is wrong? Where am I? I've got to go back to the first 5 propositions in the book if I'm repeating the same insane behavior over and over again. Is this step 1? Let's just take the kitchen truck. Am I not really admitting I'm powerless over my work situation, that my life is unmanageable? Am I not really admitting, or is it step 2? Am I not really admitting that I need to be restored to sanity in this situation? I've got a job. I've got a job. I'm making good dough. I'm being responsible. I'm bringing it home. Nobody's chiding me for this. No one's making fun of me, but my mind reading skills tell me that people are. I don't know about you, but we are, as a class, the group of the most pathetically failed mind readers I have ever met in my entire life. The defect of mind reading has appeared on my inventory so many times. What do you think? It's just unbelievable. That I assume that I, when somebody I sponsor says, "You know, this is going to sound crazy," I always say to them, "You don't know how it's going to sound. You only know how it's going to feel to say it. But if you think you know how it sounds, you're reading my mind. And no matter how, even if a vein is pumping like a garden hose on your forehead, if your brain feels like a breeder reactor, it doesn't matter. Activity doesn't count for effectiveness here. It doesn't work." So Or is it step two, do I really not believe that God is going to restore me to sanity in the area of work, that he can take care of the universe, keep Saturn on its axis, can't take care of Scott Redman in the kitchen truck? Have I not really decided that I will turn my will and my life over to the care of God in this area? Or is it step four, do I really have to have more inventory in this area? Or is it step five, have I kept certain facts about myself that are now injuring me? So I go back to the first five propositions in the book on this specific area that I can't shake loose, that I can't get movement, that I continue to return to this painful, awful, unforgiving landscape where I feel shut out of my life. And the results have been remarkable. The results have been an expansion, a widening of my experience of the first five steps and my use of the first five steps. Step 10 to me, if properly implemented, will kick me back to those first five steps and make it bigger and bigger and really show me, unfortunately, the places that I still have to grow and need movement on and need to grow in.